Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello once again, and welcome to the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. At the same time, you will hear about interesting things from around the world. We begin today with information about the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. Did you know that this special holiday does not begin at the same time for all Muslims? We will tell you what it is like for many believers in the United States. Then we are off to the movies. You've heard of Hollywood here in the States and Bollywood in India, but do you know about Nollywood? It starts with an N, right? Where could that be? What African country begins with an N? Stay with us to listen and learn with the Voice of America. The exact start of the Islamic holy month of Ramadan depends on the cycle of the moon. In the U.S., Muslims will begin fasting, praying, and gathering on Thursday. Muslims at a Los Angeles mosque describe why the month is special to them, and Kelly Jean Kelly tells us more.
People are praying at the Islamic Society of Orange County, California. The mosque is preparing for the thousands of people expected to come on June 20th, the first Saturday of Ramadan in the U.S. this year. The day is a large celebration at this mosque. Here, people are raising a tent for the party. Ramadan lasts a lunar month. Muslims around the world fast during daylight hours and study the Islamic holy book, the Quran. Sheikh Mustafa Umar is the director of education at another California mosque. He says, Ramadan teaches self-discipline. It also helps Muslims remember to be thankful for all they have.
When you go without food and drink for an entire day, even for one day, you realize what you've given up and you realize what you actually had that you had taken for granted.
The fast ends at sunset. In Orange County, many Muslims gather at the Islamic Society to share a meal and pray. Dua Alwan is president of the Islamic Society. She says, members of other faiths join the celebration too. The people, she says, are as different as the food.
You have the Pakistani food, you have Indian food, you have Middle Eastern, you have Italian food, you have Mexican food, and it really reflects, you know, the diversity that our community shares.
After they eat, they pray. Mosque member Nawaz Ahmed says, Ramadan is a time to think about how you can live a better life. It is, he says, like starting a new year. Sheikh Mustafa Umar says that Ramadan is also a time to strengthen friendships and other relations with the community. He says Muslims around the world celebrate in similar ways.
So it's kind of a mixture of, worshiping God, and also having fun and having a good time and realizing and appreciating the blessings that you have in this life.
Members of the mosque say they feel the excitement in the air, just like they do every year at the beginning of Ramadan. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Now it is time to go to the movies. Here in the United States, a movie about dinosaurs just opened. It made a huge amount of money during its first few days. It seems that many Americans like to go see a motion picture during the hot summer months. They can sit in the dark where it is cool and leave their worries behind while they visit faraway places on the movie screen. Pete Musto joins us today with movies on his mind.
Bollywood is the name of the film industry in India. The country is the world's largest filmmaker. Nollywood in Nigeria is now the world's second largest filmmaker. It produces 2,000 or more movies every year. Some of the best Nollywood films are showing at a film festival in Paris. The festival is called Nollywood Week. This is the third year the festival has taken place. Nigeria is an English-speaking country. However, festival organizer Serge Nuku says holding the festival in the French capital makes sense.
Paris is the world's cinema capital, in a way. It's really an important city for cinema. It's a city that matters. And I believe Nollywood is an industry that matters. I believe that it just made sense to have a platform here for Nollywood, and especially Nollywood's finest films.
Many different types of movies are part of the festival. They include dramas, comedies, and also a film about zombies. Festival goers can also see the popular Nigerian TV series called Before 30. The show is about how Nigerian women feel forced to get married by the time they are 30 years old. The festival began with a film called Jimmy Goes to Nollywood. It is a documentary about Haitian actor Jimmy Jean-Louis discovering the film industry. Rachid Dibou helped direct the movie. Mr. Dibou says Nigerian movies were first made with very little money. Now, the quality of the movies is much better. The newer movies are drawing international attention to Nigerian filmmakers. Ernest Mbong is from Cameroon. He works in the music industry in Paris. He attends Nollywood Week every year.
Because it brings a lot of light on the work people are doing down there, full of many things, many stories, taken from our roots. And also from what people are living daily. That's really important, interesting for all of us. And it's really entertainment.
Mr. Nuku is not sure what next year's festival will offer. He is hoping to include films from other African countries in the future. But, he says, the festival will always promote independent filmmakers because they make movies average people care about. I'm Pete Musto.
Now it is time to practice speaking American English. Save the program as a podcast. Go back and listen to the program again and again. Practice saying the words the way you hear us say them. Remember, we always speak more slowly than normal, and we always use fewer words that are easy to understand. That makes learning English fast and fun. We are here 7 days a week to inform, entertain, and teach. This is VOA, the Voice of America from Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Chinese officials are taking high-tech action against high-tech cheaters on the National College Entrance Test. In recent years, some students have used hidden electronic devices to communicate during the test. In an effort to stop them, administrators in one city took an unusual step. They used a drone or small aircraft without a pilot. The drone flew over two testing centers in Luoyang City in central China's Henan province. The drone was looking for unusual signals being sent to wireless devices. Mr. Lan, who only gave his last name, is an official from Luoyang's Radio Supervision and Regulation Bureau. He said the drone cost hundreds of thousands of yuan, or tens of thousands of U.S. dollars. He said the drone was as big as a pump at a gasoline station. Officials said that a large number of electronic signals over a testing center could mean that students were cheating by sending electronic messages during the exam. A Henan Province news website said that the drone recorded no unusual signals on the first day of the test. 9 million students will take the college entrance exam, which started last Sunday. The test is known in China as the Gaokao. This important test can greatly affect a young person's future. The test results are used to decide which kind of university a student can attend. Those with the highest scores have the best chance for getting into an elite university. Students spend months cramming or studying intensely in order to get the highest possible score. Many parents travel to the cities where the tests are given. They stay with their children during the exam, which can last 2 or 3 days. Students who do not do well on the test enter regional universities. Students who do not pass the exam usually have 2 choices. They can repeat a year of school and retake the test, or try to find a factory job. Cheating is common because of the high risk and high pressure connected to the exam. Local media have reported on the problem of surrogate test taking. A surrogate is someone who does another person's work. Talented students from poor families can earn large amounts of money taking the college entrance exam for students who can pay. More recently, students have been using wireless devices to get answers during the test. The Education Ministry said Saturday that it had arrested 23 people for trying to cheat since last May. I'm Pete Musto.
This is Richard Rail.
And this is Rich Kleinfeld with The Making of a Nation, a VOA special English program about the history of the United States. Today, we tell about the movement for civil rights for Black Americans.
The day is August 28th, 1963. More than 250,000 people are gathered in Washington. Black and white, young and old, they demand equal treatment for black Americans. The nation's most famous civil rights leader, Martin Luther King, is speaking.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation.
Early in its history, black Africans were brought to America as slaves. They were bought and sold like animals. By the time of America's Civil War in the 1860s, many had been freed by their owners. Many, however, still worked as slaves on the big farms of the South. By the end of the war, slavery had been declared unconstitutional. But that was only the first step in the struggle for equality.
Most people of color could not get good jobs. They could not get good housing. They had far less chance of a good education than white Americans. For about 100 years, blacks made slow gains. Widespread activism for civil rights did not really begin until after World War II. During the war, black Americans earned respect as members of the armed forces. When they came home, many demanded that their civil rights be respected too. An organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, led the way.
In 1951, the organization sent its lawyers to help a man in the city of Topeka, Kansas. The man, Oliver Brown, and 12 others had brought legal action against the city. They wanted to end racial separation in their children's schools. At that time, 2 of every 5 public schools in America had all white students or all black students. The law said all public schools must be equal, but they were not. Schools for white children were almost always better than schools for black children. The situation was worst in southern states.
The case against the city of Topeka, Brown versus the Board of Education, was finally settled by the nation's highest court. In 1954, the Supreme Court ruled that separate schools for black children were not equal to schools for white children. The next year, it said public schools must accept children of all races as quickly as possible.
In September 1957, a black girl tried to enter an all-white school in the city of Little Rock, Arkansas. An angry crowd screamed at her. State guards blocked her way. The guards had been sent by the state governor, Orville Faubus. After 3 weeks, a federal court ordered Governor Faubus to remove the guards. The girl, Elizabeth Eckford, and 7 other black students were able to enter the school. After 1 day, however, riots forced the black students to leave.
President Dwight Eisenhower ordered federal troops to Little Rock. They helped black students get into the white school safely. However, angry white citizens closed all the city's public schools. The schools stayed closed for 2 years. In 1962, a black student named James Meredith tried to attend the University of Mississippi. School officials refused. John Kennedy, the president at that time, sent federal law officers to help him. James Meredith became the first black person to graduate from the University of Mississippi.
In addition to fighting for equal treatment in education, black Americans fought for equal treatment in housing and transportation. In many cities of the South, blacks were forced to sit in the back of buses. In 1955, a black woman named Rosa Parks got on a bus in the city of Montgomery, Alabama. She sat in the back. The bus became crowded. There were no more seats for white people. So the bus driver ordered Mrs. Parks to stand and give her seat to a white person. She refused. Her feet were tired after a long day at work. Rosa Parks was arrested.
The Reverend Martin Luther King organized the black citizens of Montgomery. They were the major users of the bus system. They agreed to stop using the buses. The boycott lasted a little more than a year. It seriously affected the earnings of the bus company. In the end, racial separation on the buses in Montgomery was declared illegal. Rosa Parks's tired feet had helped win black Americans another victory in their struggle for equal rights, and the victory had been won without violence.
The Reverend King was following the teachings of Indian spiritual leader Mohandas Gandhi. Gandhi urged his followers to reach their political goals without violence. One of the major tools of nonviolence in the civil rights struggle in America was the sit-in. In a sit-in, protesters entered a store or public eating place. They quietly asked to be served. Sometimes they were arrested. Sometimes they remained until the business closed. But they were not served. Some went hours without food or water.
Another kind of protest was the Freedom Ride. This involved buses that traveled through states from the north to the south. On freedom rides, blacks and whites sat together to make it difficult for officials to enforce racial separation laws on the buses. Many freedom rides and much violence took place in the summer of 1964. Sometimes the Freedom Riders were arrested. Sometimes angry crowds of whites beat the Freedom Riders.
Perhaps the most dangerous part of the civil rights movement was the campaign to win voting rights for black Americans. The 15th Amendment to the Constitution said a citizen could not be denied the right to vote because of race or color. Several southern states, however, passed laws to try to deny voting rights to blacks for other reasons.
Martin Luther King and his supporters demonstrated to demand new legislation to guarantee the right to vote. They held protests in the state of Alabama. In the city of Birmingham, the chief law officer ordered his men to fight the protesters with high-pressure water hoses and fierce dogs. People throughout the country watched the demonstration on television. The sight of children being beaten by policemen and bitten by dogs awakened many citizens to the civil rights struggle. Federal negotiators reached a compromise. The compromise was, in fact, a victory for the protesters. They promised to stop their demonstrations. In exchange, they would be permitted to vote.
President Johnson signed a major civil rights bill in 1964. Yet violence continued in some places. Three civil rights workers were murdered in Mississippi. One was murdered in Alabama. Martin Luther King kept working toward the goal of equal rights. He died working. On April 4, 1968, he was shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. He had gone there to support a strike by waste collection workers. A white man, James Earl Ray, was tried and found guilty of the crime.
A wave of unrest followed the murder of Martin Luther King. Blacks in more than 100 cities in America rioted. In some cities, areas affected by the riots were not rebuilt for many years. The movement for civil rights for black Americans continued, but it became increasingly violent. The struggle produced angry, bitter memories. Yet it also produced some of the greatest words spoken in American history.
When we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
This program of The Making of a Nation was written by Jerry Watson and produced by Paul Thompson. This is Rich Kleinfeld.
And this is Richard Rail. Join us again next week for another VOA special English program about the history of the United States.